My name is Sarah, and I got involved with Vote Save America way back in 2018 when it first launched.
My name is Nancy, and I first got involved in VSA in 2018.
Ever since then, Vote Save America has been the best part of my political engagement. Anytime the election anxiety starts to feel overwhelming, I remind myself that my anxiety relief program donation is fueling grassroots organizations around the country.
And VSA has the Political Action Finder, a handy website I've used to find phone banks, knowing that I'm helping to win critical House seats.
In fact, I already signed up to volunteer with the Political Action Finder on the VSA website and helped replace disgraced former volleyball star George Santos.
So if you're someone who doesn't want to wake up on November 6th this year and regret not doing more, and I'm pretty sure you are, go to votesaveamerica.com to get started, and I'll see you at a phone bank soon.
This message has been paid for by Vote Save America. You can learn more at votesaveamerica.com. And this ad has not been authorized by any candidate or candidate's committee.
Does the political news cycle make you want to scream, cry, and maybe throw up? Pod Save America is going on tour to help you make sense of what's going on in 2024, no matter where you live. The Democracy or Else Tour will be heading all over the country to cities like Brooklyn, Boston, Madison, Phoenix, Philadelphia, Ann Arbor, and more. And for long-term scream barf protection, get the VIP ticket bundle that includes a signed copy of our new book, Democracy or Else, How to Save America in 10 Easy Steps, so you can take us with you wherever you go. See all the tour dates and get your tickets now at cricket.com/events, quick before they sell out.
Welcome back to Pod Save the World. I'm Tommy Vitor.
I'm Ben Rhodes.
Ben, the Boston Celtics and the Boston Bruins both got routed by 8 seeds in the playoffs.
Yes, yeah.
This is the future that massholes like myself deserve, no? I should just get used to this.
I mean, I think you have about 30 years of karma because of the Patriots coming
your
way.
And the Red Sox.
Yeah. And the Red Sox. I feel bad because the Bruins were like the best team ever.
And,
like,
and they got destroyed.
That was the craziest one in round one. And then to come all the way back to 3-3 in that Celtics series, and then to bring in all the videos and big guns about the Red Sox comeback. And then, you know, I was texting with friend of the pod, Samantha Power, about this yesterday.
Oh, nice.
And
she's a Seas fan?
She's a big Seas fan, and let's just say it didn't work out.
Yeah. It's not good when your best player rolls his ankle 17 seconds into the game and can't really play.
Not good. And when your whole offense seems to be just jacking threes and they're not falling, you need a plan B.
Yeah, you need a plan B. I love Boston. It's like, it's my home. It's like I identify with it so strongly, but also can be, we can be so embarrassing sometimes. Like the celebrities in the audience last night included Donnie Wahlberg, not even Mark Wahlberg, Donnie Wahlberg. Yeah. I think Stan Van Gundy confused the two at one point and said Marcus Smart was taking acting lessons from Donnie Wahlberg, who was, I think, of the New Kids. But yeah, anyway, we're not just going to chat about sports today, though I am a little sad. We're going to cover a lot of important stuff, LGBT rights in Uganda, tensions in Serbia, and how professional tennis is involved. There's a sports nexus there, Ben. Reports about Trump's ballooning legal jeopardy in the Mar-a-Lago classified documents case. What the CIA knows or does not know when it comes to Israel's intentions, when it comes to potentially bombing Iran. The latest in Ukraine, why China is giving the Pentagon the cold shoulder. How Poland could use fears of Russian political interference to silence opposition leaders. Elon Musk is in China. Free speech.
What could go wrong?
Absolutist.
The mecca of free speech.
Venezuela has been welcomed back into the South American fold. And then there's the ongoing desperation of Boris Johnson, just for fun, Ben. And then you're going to hear my interview with journalist and author Ece Temelkoran about how Turkish President Tayyip Erdogan unfortunately won re-election and what it means for the future of Turkey. Ben, spoiler alert, it's not great.
So the thing is, Tommy, you know, the quote that leads my last book, After the Fall, is from her.
Oh, yeah? What was it?
The final takeover does not happen with one spectacular Reichstag conflagration, but is instead an excruciating years-long process of many scattered, seemingly insignificant little fires that smolder without flames.
Ooh, that's a hell of a quote.
Which is, you know, a cheerful way to describe what we've all been living through.
Yeah.
it's a more eloquent way of saying that the nationalists are boiling the frog.
And for Turkey, it's been 20 years of this.
20 years, right? 20 years. Imagine 20 years of Trump.
No, I can't. Ugh, well, that's a a great quote. But then speaking of excellent books, like After the Fall, I know you're a big reader, and you will be excited to know that Crooked Media Reads, our imprint, our first book, Mobility, is available for pre-order. Mobility is by Lydia Kiesling. She's the author of The Golden States, great book. Worldos will love that this book kicks off in Azerbaijan, in Baku, in the 90s.
Couldn't find a more Worldo locale than Baku in the 90s. Swinging Baku.
That's right. We're wrestling for influence. The U.S. is access to oil and gas infrastructure in the region, but it's also a coming-of-age novel about class and power and politics, and it's just a fun summer read. Pulitzer Prize winner Geraldine Brooks called Mobility a masterpiece of misdirection and a cautionary tale for our times. Check it out. Go to crooked.com/books. Pre-order your copy of Mobility today and be the first to read when it's released on August 1st. I don't know how you write a full book. I can barely get a tweet out.
The best advice I ever got on writing a book, and I'm on my third now, which is feeling very difficult to do with my time allotments, was E.L. Doctorow, the famous novelist, once said that writing a book is like driving at night with headlights. You can't see your destination, but you can see what's right in front of you.
That's good advice.
And so if you just think about doing the piece that's right in front of you, eventually you get there.
A couple pages a day finally adds up.
It adds up. Yeah.
Yeah. Still, sounds pretty hard. Yeah. Okay. All right. Let's talk about the news, Ben, because on Monday, Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni signed into law one of the harshest anti-LGBT bills in the world. Anyone who engages in gay sex in Uganda can get life in prison. Even minors can be sentenced up to 3 years. And just attempting to have same-sex relations can get you 10 years in prison. They also created this new category they call aggravated homosexuality, which could result in the death penalty. That category is basically, you know, sex with kids, disabled people, rape. Activists and aid groups are particularly worried about parts of the law that create criminal penalties for promoting homosexuality and provisions that encourage the public to report on others. So they're really worried about vigilante justice. The U.S. and other Western governments lobbied hard against this bill. Biden called it shameful and said the National Security Council, his staff, will review the entire U.S.-Uganda relationship, in particular, America's ability to safely deliver HIV/AIDS services. Ted Cruz even denounced this law. That's how bad it is. At the same time, unfortunately, though, American right-wing religious groups have helped promote these laws and anti-LGBT sentiment in general in Uganda. Uganda passed a similar law back in 2014 that got struck down on procedural grounds. So this is like them coming back at this. More broadly on the continent, homosexuality is criminalized in 30 of 54 countries in Africa. Former British colonies are far more likely to criminalize homosexuality than non-former British colonies. That was interesting. But Reuters did a poll of 48,000 Africans across 34 countries, where more than 75% of respondents across all ages said they would be strongly or somewhat dislike having a gay neighbor. So there's really some entrenched, unfortunate views here. And unlike most countries, young people are essentially just as likely to have anti-LGBT views as older people. So it's not improving over time. So Ben, you know, South Africa is the only country in Africa to allow LGBTQ couples to marry, enter civil unions, and adopt children. We've talked a bunch of times how there is this sense in across the continent of Africa, a well-deserved sense, that the U.S. shows up to lecture them and then leaves. How do you think Biden's team can or should go about pushing back on laws like this, where, you know, this is really like a basic human rights issue? It's an enormous, it's scary growing trend. And there are people, you know, in Uganda and across the continent who really want our support, but also don't want to, you know, create a political context where the U.S. is doing more harm than good.
Well, I mean, I think there was a precedent, you know, back in 2014, as you mentioned, this, I remember this kind of law coming down the transom in Uganda. There was a lot of international pressure, including from the U.S., and they kind of did back down. So the first point is, I think you do have to put things, tangible things, on the table. Uganda's gotten assistance from the United States in the past, had a security relationship with Museveni. And I do think that there are certain laws that are just kind of beyond the pale, because this is not just an LGBTQ issue. This is, as you said, it's like a fundamental human rights issue.
Yep.
When you have a whole community of people being stigmatized, marginalized, and facing punishment in this way. So I think the first thing is, this is a case where, you know, when you're calibrating these efforts around human rights and democracy, sometimes you can't make the perfect the enemy of the good, right? You have to understand you can't dictate terms and laws in every country. But you have to be able to identify, well, what crosses certain lines where we will reevaluate our relationship. This is one of those places. That's the first thing. I think the second thing is there really is a unholy relationship between some of these anti-LGBTQ laws in Africa and the U.S. evangelical community. And look, it's all well and good for like a Ted Cruz to come out and say this law is wrong. I'm glad he did. But what you really need is more responsible voices in that community to try to slow down this train, if not turn it around. And so, you know, there is a tradition of Republicans in Congress in particular who've been, you know, champions for things like PEPFAR, the anti-HIV/AIDS initiative that has done a lot of good in Africa, that have...
Best thing George W. Bush ever did.
Best thing he did
by far.
That have deep relationships in Africa. I think you need to be figuring out how to quietly try to mobilize those people to restrain some of the more extreme elements of their own community and perhaps use their own relationships in Africa to air different views. And then to this broader issue that you describe, I mean, I do think you need to find cultural messengers with some credibility with African publics so that it's not just like U.S. politicians talking about these things. But look, there's a long-term effort that's going to have to be made to try to destigmatize LGBTQ people in certain parts of the world. You have to find credible voices in that effort beyond the political sphere, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think that's something that people need to be working on too.
Yeah, it's a really good point. Man, what a terrible choice. I mean, administering and delivering HIV/AIDS drugs under the PEPFAR program or cutting that aid off because of this law. I mean, that's just an incredibly difficult decision.
It is a great, and I think you have to have a very high threshold for cutting off that kind of assistance. But there are other parts of the U.S.-Uganda relationship that you could start with.
Yeah, like military support.
There's military support. Always. There's other kinds of development assistance. So, you put that last on the list, I think.
Yeah, for sure. I think they're reviewing it in part because they don't know that their staff on the ground can safely administer it given this new law.
Yeah. Which is
understandable.
Which is ultimately a threshold that you have to be able to answer.
Yes, absolutely. Switching gears here to Serbia and Kosovo. So 25 NATO peacekeepers in northern Kosovo were injured during attacks by Serb protesters on Monday. These protesters were angry because last month, Kosovo's Serb population boycotted some local elections. The resulting low turnout meant that ethnic Albanians won a number of seats like mayoralships and jobs like that. And then after those politicians were installed into office last week, angry protesters tried to storm several local government offices and they clashed with these NATO troops. And some of these troops were severely hurt. Several Hungarian and Italian soldiers serving in the NATO peacekeeping force were injured. Leaders in Serbia and Kosovo, you know, blamed each other for raising the tensions. The Serbian president, Aleksandar Vučić, even raised the military's combat readiness to its highest level. So that's pretty ominous. The U.S. criticized authorities in Kosovo for installing these mayors in Serb-majority areas where they clearly had no popular support. The key context for everyone to remember is that Kosovo declared independence from Serbia back in 2008, but many ethnic Serbs have never accepted that, especially in the northern part of the country. Ben, this is the latest in a series of flare-ups between the two sides that sort of start with these local issues, like it was license plates at one point a couple months ago. How worried are you getting that you could see things spiral out of control in the near future?
I think people should be very worried, and I think people should see this as an issue that is really important, obviously, in Serbia and Kosovo, but is bigger than that as well. Part of what's happening here at core is that you had this repression of ethnic Albanians in Kosovo that led to a NATO intervention in the Clinton years that saved a bunch of lives, but kind of led to the end of Slobodan Milosevic's rule in Serbia, and led to this unresolved status of Kosovo. Is it independent as Kosovo has declared and as the U.S. and a whole bunch of other countries have recognized? Or from the Serbian perspective, they see parts of Kosovo, particularly these majority Serbian parts, as kind of fundamental to their identity, fundamental to their history, and they are backed by Russia and China. And so you see that the same geopolitical fault lines that we walk across every week on this podcast, like run directly through this part of Kosovo.
Did you see that Serb protesters painted the letter Z on NATO vehicles, like to mimic the Russian invasion force in Ukraine?
Yes, absolutely.
But no one's hiding the Russian piece of
Nobody's hiding the Russian piece of this. And so the bet that was made, I think, around Kosovo independence was that both Serbia and Kosovo had kind of the enticement of EU integration, that someday they might be able to join the European Union, and that could give them incentives to normalize their relations, kind of work through some, you know, maybe some autonomy for some of these like majority Serbian areas. That's clearly not working. that was the old globalization playbook, and it's just not working.
Right.
You know? And to your point, the Russians are clearly stirring this pot. Right now, you've got a nationalist president of Serbia. You also have a nationalist president of Kosovo. The Russians are not hiding this. Like I saw Sergei Lavrov, the longtime foreign minister of Russia, said the other day that, quote, Serbs are fighting for their rights in northern Kosovo. A big explosion is looming in the heart of Europe. Those are Lavrov's words, right? So what would Russia want more today than another flare-up of instability and violence in the heart of Europe that embarrasses NATO, that makes them look feckless, that makes them look like incapable of managing this issue that was one of NATO's major interventions in its recent history? So there's a lot of incentive for the Russians to be pushing Serbia to take a hard line and maybe to be pushing some of these, you know, Serbian separatist actors to be doing what they're doing. And that's kind of like back to the drawing board here. I'm just trying to avoid escalation for the time being. And the U.S. has been kind of pressuring Kosovo to dial back, you know, pushing the envelope in these areas and to show some restraint. I think ultimately that's the wise decision. You want to just reduce tensions and let this thing park itself for the time being.
Yeah, because not a lot of upside to installing a bunch of mayors the day we need. Like, maybe slow down a little bit.
Is that really worth the risk
No.
here? And especially when Russia is jonesing for an excuse to stir up, you know, real violence in the heart of Europe to create a distraction or yet another boiling pot in addition to Ukraine.
Yeah, and then the tennis piece of this is Novak Djokovic, the 22-time Grand Slam champion, wrote in Serbian on a TV camera at Roland Garros at the French Open, Kosovo is the heart of Serbia, stop the violence, which sounds like to, I don't know, your average viewer, probably kind of innocuous, but really is, you know, it's a clear statement undercutting Kosovo's independence. I think Djokovic is an ethnic Serb. His father was born in Kosovo. He thinks Kosovo is part of Serbia. And he's writing this on the lens of a camera while playing.
Yeah. I have to say, we've learned a fair amount about Djokovic. There's a reason that he's made more appearances on this podcast than any other tennis player in recent years, and none of it's good. Remember,
by a factor of 20.
Anti-vax guy, like refused to get vaxxed before he went to the Australian Open, got kicked out of that country. He's kind of weighed in, you know, generally in the flavor of that kind of stew of Russian anti-vax nationalist conspiracy theories. And to say, like, Kosovo is the heart of Serbia is about as provocative a statement as you can make on a current geopolitical area of tension. So I would hope that he's dissuaded from using his platform, pretty massive platform at the French Open, from doing so.
Yeah, a bunch of NATO peacekeepers just got the shit beaten out of them by Serb nationalists.
And you're basically writing a slogan that could be a piece of graffiti on the wall.
Right, backing them.
Yeah, with a Z over it.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. What an asshole. Speaking of assholes, Ben, there's been a bunch of reporting.
Good transition.
Thank you. Recently, that suggests Trump is in serious legal jeopardy over the handling of classified documents that he stole and hoarded at Mar-a-Lago. So we talked last week about how Special Prosecutor Jack Smith had subpoenaed a bunch of Trump's business records with seven foreign countries, including some of our favorites in the Gulf. Since then, The Washington Post has reported that Trump's team moved boxes of records at Mar-a-Lago the day before the FBI visited in June of last year. The Post also reported that, quote, Trump and his aides also allegedly carried out a dress rehearsal for moving sensitive papers even before his office received the May 2022 subpoena. You got to practice your crimes to get them right. Then on Tuesday, The Guardian reported that Evan Corcoran, Trump's lawyer, has been managing this issue, told his associates that he was misled when he tried to do a search at Mar-a-Lago for classified materials. Apparently, members of Trump's team told Corcoran not to search Trump's office, where the FBI later found some of the most sensitive stuff. That's how I assume prosecutors convince a judge to pierce Trump and Corcoran's attorney-client privilege, because Trump may have used Corcoran's legal advice in furtherance of a crime. So, Ben, I have no idea if these news reports are accurate. I mean, I assume they are. The Trump people deny them, it's worth saying. But it seems like someone is going to get charged with obstruction of justice in the very near future.
Yeah, this is like a pretty open and shut case, you know?
In many ways.
In many ways, yeah. I mean, there was, you know, we talked about the New York one is kind of this bank shot legal theory, right, of like hush money payments as a crime.
Right, state law, yeah.
This is like you're not supposed to take the classified documents with you. Mm-hmm. If you do, you get kind of a warning and this opportunity to return them. And then if you continue to not do that, you are committing a crime. And then if they want to come pick up the evidence of the crime and you got a bunch of people like throwing misdirection and misinformation at the FBI and then furiously hiding boxes, like it is pretty evident that they committed at a minimum obstruction of justice. And like the underlying question of why, again, why were they so intent on hiding this material?
I know.
Because like, it, like, let's say they did just take some letters for, you know, for nostalgia, sentimental purposes. Like, I don't know that you would go to great lengths to hide that from the FBI, you know?
Right. And again, to your point, like, not well hidden from the FBI. There's security cameras showing these people moving boxes in and out of these rooms. I was very much in the, like, kind of selfish moron Occam's razor camp of, like, Trump wanted to keep his documents because he thinks they're his and he's just a brat about everything. I have moved considerably into a more conspiratorial and darker place given the subpoena of these records, including of Trump's dealings with the LIV golf tour, which is just the perfect way to wash money coming back to him for, I don't know, maybe some information. I mean, every day we learn something new. And it, look, we're all burned by the Mueller probe, right? And all the leaks in the New York Times about, you know, whatever. So I think we're all a little bit jaded when it comes to believing that this stuff could be real. But I don't know. It seems like they got it pretty dead to rights.
No, let's speculate rashly here.
I love it.
But like there's a lot of smoke here, right?
So
this is actually not that rash, right? We're going to roll the tape all the way back to our friend Jared Kushner, right? And there were those reports that really jumped out to us at the time when Mohammed bin Salman was like detaining his family members in the Ritz-Carlton and purging members of the royal family. There were those reports that maybe Jared Kushner had shared some intelligence on what members of the family might not be totally with the program. Mm-hmm. We still don't know that that's the case. But the reason I mention it is because the U.S. intelligence community collects like vast troves of information about the Middle East, you know, about things that are going on in Saudi and the Gulf, but also about things that the Saudis are really interested in, like, you know, political developments in neighboring countries, nuclear issues in Iran or, you know, Israel or, you know, the status of whatever is happening in Libya or Sudan, any number of things that don't seem like the absolute front burner intelligence thing. So it may not be that, like, you know, Trump is sitting there holding the blueprints to, you know, every single last nut and bolt of information. But if he has anything that he was like grabbed on the way out and was like, oh, this might be of interest to the Saudis down the line, you know, which could be a lot of things, right?
Yeah.
Maybe he just had a few folders of stuff because he thought it might impress and help curry favor with some of these people that he wants to, you know, extract money from or build a relationship with, like the fucking LIV golf tour, whatever the thing is. It's an entirely plausible scenario that he had some of that stuff amongst other stuff, maybe like love letters from Kim Jong-un, and wouldn't want the FBI to get that stuff because he wouldn't know how to explain why he had it there. So he's trying to move it around or something, right?
Yeah.
That's one theory. I'm getting a little more specific than previous rash speculation, but when you look at these different reports of them like trying to move around certain stuff and kind of make certain stuff harder to find, at the same time that we're hearing that there are these investigations into the relationship he had with seven countries and the LIV golf tour might have featured, everything we know about his transactional relationship and his son-in-law's transactional relationship with the Gulf countries suggests that why would Trump not potentially wanted to take some information that could be valuable to them.
Yeah, and remember that, you know, Jared Kushner got $2 billion from the Saudis despite having no investment experience for his little investment company. But yeah, to your point, again, bucket this into the rank speculation category. But Mohammed bin Salman knows that the United States and the Turkish government had him dead to rights when it comes to ordering the hit on Jamal Khashoggi, the Washington Post journalist who was murdered in the consulate in Istanbul. I bet MBS would love to know
valuable,
how he got that.
How valuable would that report be?
How would he like?
Because, you know, I'm sure that there is somewhere like a stapled, you know, 20-page summary of the case against Mohammed bin Salman. Just think about how valuable a piece of information that he would want to know what the U.S. knows, how we know it.
How we know it. Who talked.
Who might have talked. I mean, this is not trivial stuff.
That is stuff that's worth billions.
Yeah.
Speaking of intelligence collection in the Middle East, Ben, there is another news report based on the leak of classified Pentagon documents to the social media site Discord. This time it's about Iran. One intelligence document says that the CIA doesn't know whether Israel is seriously planning to bomb Iran's nuclear infrastructure or whether these recent military exercises and hawkish rhetoric is just designed to deter them, frighten people in Iran, frighten their leadership. There's a story in The Intercept that also looks at Biden's, you know, seemingly more hawkish position on Iran. Jake Sullivan, Joe Biden's national security advisor, gave a speech where he recently said, quote, "We have made clear to Iran that it can never be permitted to obtain a nuclear weapon." And he later said, "As President Biden has repeatedly reaffirmed, he will take the actions that are necessary to stand by this statement, including by recognizing Israel's freedom of action." Two things that jumped out at me here, Ben, when I read the story. The first is, I did wonder whether intelligence about Iran's military intentions would be so close hold that it maybe wouldn't wind up in a document like this. I'm curious if you have a take there. Ben, two, I'm curious how you interpret Jake saying that Biden will recognize Israel's freedom of action when it comes to Iran. That seemed pretty different than the Obama era policy of actively dissuading them from starting World War III in the Middle East.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it doesn't surprise me. I wouldn't expect the CIA or the U.S. intelligence community to know what Israel's intentions are. I think, you know, I don't think it reveals anything to say, like, in the Obama years, when this was also a very live question, I think it was generally thought that this would be an incredibly closely held. Let's just say that the Israeli government probably wouldn't be running some broad interagency process to consider whether or not to bomb Iran.
Bibi, his defense minister, Jeff Goldberg at The Atlantic.
Yeah.
That's an inside nerd joke.
Recent podcast guest. No, but they have like what's called the security cabinet, which is like an inner cabinet of like the most senior security officials. And I think it's generally believed by analysts, and again, this is not even an intelligence statement, that like this would be restricted to a few people, if that, you know, before it start. It wouldn't start to bleed out into the U.S. intelligence community knowing something probably until they were actually already beginning to do it.
Yeah, I mean, plans are on the shelf,
right?
Bibi one day would say, okay, take the plan off the shelf, implement it.
Just go, Yeah, because they've done immense planning and to generate options for this. I agree on the formulation from Jake Sullivan. Like the Obama-era formulation was, you know, Iran must be, the first part of that we would have said, you know, they must be prohibited from developing a nuclear weapon. And we would say, like, all options are on the table, you know.
Right.
But then, usually when he said that, it was followed by a bunch of paragraphs about why we shouldn't use a military option, why we're pursuing an Iran nuclear agreement. All that, you know, context is now gone, right? And to say that, you know, we recognize Israel's freedom of action, it's not just that statement. It's that statement without all the other language about, this is a bad idea, don't do it.
Right,
you know?
Or any live effort to get back in the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear agreement. I mean, that thing's just dead.
It's dead. And again, this is just sitting there, and Iran is sitting on the precipice of having enough material for a nuclear weapon. They obviously, we've talked about how they'd have to take some extra time to weaponize it. But this continues to be a space where, you know, Israel could be on something of a hair trigger. And statements like that, you know, could be used after the fact to say, well, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, after the fact, you said we had freedom of action. We chose to act, you know.
Oh, I feel like even far less specific diplomatic pablum has been used by foreign countries to say, we thought you gave us the green light to attack X, Y, or Z country.
And so it makes me wonder. I mean, I have to think that the U.S. is privately cautioning against, you know, doing something that could precipitate another war on top of the wars we're already managing. But yeah, this is one that, you know, you wonder whether Bibi might want to, if he wants to take this risk, given the combination of his own political challenges at home and a U.S. election cycle in which Trump will support anything and everything he does, whether he might think that he can gradually box Biden in to not dissuading him.
Not good. Scary. Watch this space. Ben, speaking of nuclear confrontation, the Wall Street Journal reported that the Chinese government refused a request for a meeting between the U.S. Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, and the Chinese defense minister, Li Shengfu, at an upcoming security meeting in Singapore. There's a lot of concern in Washington, as I think we've talked about on the show, about China's refusal to establish regular military-to-military communications with the U.S. or create some sort of hotline to manage a future crisis like the balloon idiocy. Some of this meeting refusal likely is residual anger about the U.S. shooting down the Chinese spy balloon. But Ben, the Journal story also mentioned that the U.S. still has sanctions on Defense Minister Li that were put in place in 2018 by the Trump administration because Li approved the purchase of Russian fighter jets and Russian missiles. Call me crazy, but would you take a meeting with the government that was sanctioning you? I'm like, I wonder, isn't that maybe most of the problem here?
Might sour the mood a little bit. A couple things on this. First of all, I don't know if you've ever been to the Shangri-La Dialogue in Singapore.
No, I've heard it's great.
So the Shangri-La Dialogue is, you've heard us kind of talk about the Munich Security Conference, which is kind of like the prom for transatlanticists, security types. The Shangri-La Dialogue is like the Asian version of the Munich Security Conference.
Okay.
Or you might even say the Munich Security Conference is the European version of the Shangri-La Dialogue.
That's what I like.
So all the muckety-mucks, all the defense ministers, all the Henry Kissingers love to show up at this place. And so this will like reverberate. Point is that the absence of this meeting will be the hallway chatter at the Shangri-La Dialogue, and it'll kind of contribute to this sense that the U.S. and China are careening in this, direction of conflict and Cold War. I think what's happened here, in addition to the guy being sanctioned, is the Chinese had this entire sequence kind of mapped out for the year, right? Which was like Biden was going to meet with Xi Jinping in Bali at the G20 in November. That happened. And then it was going to be followed up by all these engagements that were kind of sequenced. Like Tony Blinken was going to go over there.
Yes, Tony had a trip.
And then Lloyd Austin would have this meeting. And I think that once the balloon thing derailed their carefully constructed engagement plan and Tony Blinken canceled his trip, they're kind of like, okay, that's all off. Like, wipe the slate clean. And it's probably, in their mind, going to take another Biden-Xi Jinping meeting or interaction to be the umbrella to then resume these kind of more thorny cabinet-level discussions. So I think it's just a sign that the whole relationship is in deep freeze since that balloon thing. And it's going to take kind of a presidential-level engagement to unstick it.
Yeah, and Biden keeps getting asked about this. And he'll say, like, yeah, no, no call plan, but I think it's going to happen. And then he'll often say, but we really got to reestablish this hotline. You know, like, they're not hiding what they want out of Washington, isn't. And Jake Sullivan had this eight-hour meeting in Vienna with his counterpart recently. I was hoping that might unstick some of this stuff, but apparently not the Shangri-La, which is kind of why I'm wearing, like, I'm wondering, I don't know, I'm just hoping, I guess, that the sanction piece of this is carrying some added weight and that isn't a broader relationship thing, but maybe that's wrong.
Yeah, it feels broader to me, but it probably doesn't help, and you might want to, just look at the Trump-era sanctions again, particularly in light of the fact
All
that the guy's the defense minister. But the we've come a long way from when Biden used to brag on the campaign that he had spent more time with Xi Jinping than any living human being on earth. Remember those days?
That's like the talking
and
point
now
these
it's
days.
Like, I'll get around to calling him at some point, but we can have a hotline,
A hotline would be good. Speaking of China, Ben. So free speech absolutist, newly minted Republican hero Elon Musk traveled to Beijing.
Did Secretary of State David Sachs accompany him?
I don't know.
Sorry, that's too inside.
I'll check. Elon had meetings with Chinese state counselor and foreign minister Tin Gang. This was on Tuesday. Here's what a Chinese government spokesperson tweeted about the meeting. Here's a quote. Promoting sound China-U.S. relations is like driving a car. One needs to keep to the right direction, hit the brakes when the road is bumpy, and step on the gas for mutually beneficial cooperation. Then now they started speaking for Musk. Musk said that with hardworking and talented people, China's development makes perfect sense. hashtag Tesla opposes decoupling or cutting off supply chains. It is ready to expand business in China and share in China's development opportunities. Ben, I saw that Fidelity said that they have marked down the value of their stake in Twitter and believe it's now worth one-third of what Elon paid for it. I wonder if that is part of why he's traveling to China to kiss the ring, to keep the Tesla sales going and maybe not bringing up, free speech.
Yeah, there's so much going on here. I love this story. Every now and then when you send topics and I just, because this is so many dimensions to this one. you know, because the first thing is obviously like when you buy one of the larger social media platforms in the world, and particularly one that has outsized influence on political questions, and then you go hat in hand and kowtow to the most totalitarian government in the world that seeks to use Twitter to identify critics in other countries. Mm-hmm. You know, I've heard stories in recent months of Chinese citizens who've been arrested on return to China, for instance, because of things that they posted on social media in other countries. Oh, man. They obviously want to censor certain things on Twitter or control it even outside of China's borders. And they certainly run significant amounts of state-sponsored disinformation campaigns on Twitter.
Constantly.
This is well-documented, right?
Constantly.
So this is not like Elon Musk owns a platform that the Chinese government uses to monitor people and to spread disinformation across the West, and he's going there and kissing their ass. That should make you wonder about, you know, where Twitter's going and what it serves. It certainly should make you question whether his real interest is free speech or whether it's a mixture of vanity and anti-woke politics, right? I mean, this guy, there's nothing about his interactions in China suggests that this guy genuinely cares at all about free speech.
Well, and you know who agrees with us here is my buddy Steve Bannon, who's constantly attacking Elon and saying he's just a tool of the CCP, which is, you know, overstated and ridiculous. But there are some on the right in the Republican Party who are calling bullshit on this. And this photo op in Beijing will not help him with those people.
No, and it's interesting to the extent to which he you know, Elon, at the end of the day, despite the plummeting Twitter market cap, you know, like, or I guess it's private again now, right?
Yeah, sure.
So whatever. I do believe that ultimately, like, his core wealth depends on Tesla,
for sure.
SpaceX,
no doubt.
Supply chains in China are part of that. Customer base in China is part of that. That he'll always put that interest ahead of whatever his hobby horse politically is.
And this meeting made shares of Tesla go up 5% today.
Yeah, no, and so it served that purpose. But like Ron DeSantis, like, let's put the question to him, because I'm sure he's going to be running as an anti-CCP warrior.
No doubt.
What it exposes is that this kind of crypto bro tech anti-woke, anti-ESG, anti-DEI, you know, universe of people that the GOP thinks are now part of their tent, like, are just diametrically opposed to them on a core issue of China. And so whenever you see Elon buddying up with Ron DeSantis, just keep that in mind. You know, one of those people is a hypocrite, if not both, probably both. But the other thing is the decoupling language is interesting, because for all of his vaunted influence, Elon Musk cannot stop decoupling. It is happening.
No doubt.
U.S. government, which is more powerful than Elon Musk and wealthier than Elon Musk, is setting up a massive regime of export controls to deny technology into China, to deny U.S. investment into China. And ultimately, that's going to ensnare aspects of Elon Musk's enterprise. And going over there and kissing the ring, whatever you think about that decoupling, is not going to reverse it, you know?
Yeah, and now Twitter has become a place where, like, right-wing morons who bought blue checks, who a year ago complained about cancel culture, are now trying to lead boycotts of Chick-fil-A for hiring a VP of diversity.
Yeah.
It's like, all right, this is how you spend your time now?
Yeah, that's that's free speech.
Yeah,
it's
speech.
You know?
A little whiplash.
Is the Falun Gong on there? Like, what's old Elon doing to juice the Falun Gong on Twitter?
I don't know. Let's find out. Yeah.
Support for Pod Save the World comes from the International Rescue Committee. The IRC works in more than 50 countries, serving people whose lives have been upended by war, conflict, and natural disasters. In places like Gaza, Ukraine, and Sudan, displaced families are experiencing war, extreme hunger, and life-threatening injuries. In Gaza, ongoing violence, bombardment, and blockade have made survival difficult for families living in damaged buildings and tents. The lack of safe water, medicine, and healthy food contributes to the spread of diseases, and children are especially at risk. The International Rescue Committee is working with local partners in Gaza to provide life-saving medical care to injured civilians. The IRC works around the world to help families in crisis by delivering critical supplies such as therapeutic food for malnourished children, clean water, cash assistance, and more. Your donation will support this work and help children and families survive. Listen, the International Rescue Committee is an incredible organization. They are doing the Lord's work all around the globe. I have donated to them, you know, for many, many years now, because I know that my dollar will go towards helping people. It's not going to go to administrative costs or overhead fees. It's just an incredible group doing great work. I hope you'll consider them. Donate today by visiting rescue.org/rebuild. That's rescue.org/rebuild.
Come on, jump!
I don't know if I'll make it!
Hurry! The floor is lava!
Oops. Hey, life happens. Which is why your favorite styles from Ashley are available in life-resistant, high-performance fabric with removable, machine-washable fabric slipcovers that make it easy to clean spills, dirt, and imaginary lava. For more mess and less stress, shop Ashley's high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
My name is Sarah, and I got involved with Vote Save America way back in 2018 when it first launched.
My name is Nancy, and I first got involved in VSA in 2018.
Ever since then, Vote Save America has been the best part of my political engagement. Anytime the election anxiety starts to feel overwhelming, I remind myself that my anxiety relief program donation is fueling grassroots organizations around the country.
And VSA has the Political Action Finder, a handy website I've used to find phone banks, knowing that I'm helping to win critical seats.
In fact, I already signed up to volunteer with the Political Action Finder on the VSA website and helped replace disgraced former volleyball star George Santos.
So if you're someone who doesn't want to wake up on November 6th this year and regret not doing more, and I'm pretty sure you are, go to votesaveamerica.com to get started, and I'll see you at a phone bank soon.
This message has been paid for by Vote Save America. You can learn more at votesaveamerica.com, and this ad has not been authorized by any candidate or candidates committee. It was a terrifying night for people in Ukraine, especially in Kyiv, the capital, where local officials say they were subjected to the largest drone attack since the start of the war. The AP said the attack lasted more than 5 hours, and Ukrainian air defenses luckily shot down more than 40 drones. But it was an attack timed for a celebration of Kyiv's founding and the third straight night of heavy bombardment. So just absolutely terrifying for people who live there, and no one slept in Kyiv for 3 days. However, at the same time, Moscow was attacked by drones on Tuesday in the middle of the night. The Russian Defense Ministry said Russian air defenses shot down 5 drones and caused 3 others to veer off course, causing minor damage to civilian buildings. The Kremlin has been downplaying these attacks. Ukraine denied it was them, but did their usual kind of like shitposting adjacent, like you love to see it, you know, we expect more of this to happen kind of stuff. Ben, it's hard to get a good read on public opinion in Russia, but there was a BBC report I heard today where they interviewed some sort of like random Russian civilians who were near where this explosions happened in Moscow. And they said the drone attack made them feel like things were not as calm and stable as they'd been led to believe, and that a war that had once felt far away was reaching them close to home. If that's the impact on Russian public opinion, you have to think that these cross-border attacks are going to ramp up dramatically.
Absolutely. You know, and we've been talking about
this for months,
almost every week, but it just keeps happening. Clearly, Ukraine has made a decision to do this. And in this case, there are a couple of things that are noteworthy about it. First is that, assuming they control the timing, and some aspect of the Ukrainian government or special services seems to control this thing, they were being attacked in Kyiv, and so they're reciprocating in their minds.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to therefore time our response to those attacks. The other thing that's interesting in both directions is use of drones, right? Because it's a lot cheaper to just arm some kamikaze drones and send them somewhere than it is to like have a bunch of, you know, precision guided missiles.
Right.
You know, and so already we've seen Russians, in part because they're having trouble with Ukrainian air defenses, as we've given them Patriot batteries and things like that, pivot to like first these Iranian kamikaze drones, and then the Russians must be just turning these things out. And so increasingly you see this kind of, these drone attacks, which are, can terrorize, but they can't destroy kind of as much infrastructure. But that shows you we're in this new world of drone warfare. You know, we got accustomed to thinking about drones, and you and I were obviously a part of this, as these sophisticated targeted assassination
potentially
weapons.
Super precise.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now it's the opposite. It's now, like swarms of like model airplanes.
That's right. And by the way, AI is coming down the pike. We haven't talked about the killer robots yet. You mean, this could all be AI run within, you know, a relatively short period of time. And so the Ukrainians have found this kind of cost-effective asymmetric way to strike back. And the question is, what happens if that actually starts killing people or destroying things instead of just, you know, launching these kind of campaigns of see what we can do? because you have to think at some point it will. I think on Russian public opinion, you know, there have been a couple of like surveys recently that indicated that if you kind of, if you run a net through Telegram, which is the main Russian social mm-hmm. media app, you find kind of growing frustration with casualties. You also see these nationalist voices, like to Putin's right, calling into question, like even after this episode, do we control our own airspace? How come we can't stop this? I think it is a problem for the Kremlin. And that too will reinforce Ukraine's desire to do it. Which, again, reminds you that the more this war goes on, the more there's risks of things escalating, of something happening that triggers a response, that triggers a counter response. And once you get into this kind of stuff, I think you just don't know what Putin might do at some point.
Yeah, and more just, you know, innocent people potentially dying in Moscow and Kyiv and everywhere else. Did you see the Ukrainians released more footage of a drone boat attacking another, you know, Russian military vessel? Like, I basically just hitting the side of it and exploding, and the video goes dark. I mean, there things are everywhere now.
Things everywhere now, and the Russians, as they've depleted their stockpiles, they're going to be turning more to these kind of crude drone-type attacks as well. So it's a different, you know, kind of war. On the one end, you have this kind of World War I-style front line with artillery, but then on the other end, you have all this mechanized and drone-type warfare. I'd say it's interesting, except it's tragic.
Yeah, it's absolutely tragic. The other thing that came out of Russia was the Russian Interior Ministry issued an arrest warrant for South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham in response to comments Graham made while in Kyiv last week for a meeting with President Zelensky. The weird thing about this is that Russia was mad about a total misrepresentation of what Graham said. President Zelensky's office released a misleadingly edited video of Graham speaking, which combined separate comments. One time he said, the Russians are dying. And he also said the Ukraine assistance was the best money we've ever spent. Obviously, the two are linked in some sense, but he didn't put them together in one sentence. Despite the Ukrainians basically getting him an international arrest warrant, Graham seems cool with it all. He tweeted, quote, to know that my commitment to Ukraine has drawn the ire of Putin's regime brings me immense joy. And quote, I will wear the arrest warrant issued by Putin's corrupt and immoral government as a badge of honor. I am tempted to make a joke about a prisoner exchange, but I won't, Ben, because we're much more mature than that. Mm-hmm. But I do think we should just sort of admire how perfectly stupid and shitty this is. Like, Ms. Zelensky's office should not have misleadingly edited this video and made it look like Graham was like thrilled that Russian civilians are dying. The Russians overreact. Graham is cool with it because it helps him politically, like rinse, repeat. It's just a weird
everything about thing. This is dumb. You're right, because like the way that quote was edited, and we've all watched these videos, like Zelensky's social media like churns these out, and one will be about like, you know, Sean Penn came to see me, and then the next one is like Lindsey Graham talking about dying Russians.
Boris Johnson high fives him on the way in. Yeah.
And I don't want to diminish it. And then a lot of it is like very poignant and powerful leadership from Zelensky. But there is a trolling aspect to
it. For sure.
And juxtaposing, you know, the Russians are dying, best investment we made. The Russian narrative is, oh, they're committing war crimes just like we are. So we're all war criminals and everybody does it. And
exactly.
And that's what they're trying to foster. And I think you should try to deny them that. So the reason I critique the Ukrainians is you don't want to write their talking points for them. And if their talking points are just pure whataboutism, don't do that. But the other thing I will say, Tommy, is like, as we talked about, like I was on the first sanctions list in 2014 with a friend of the pod, Worldo, at least Worldo spouse, Dan Pfeiffer, because mm-hmm. I know Howley's an avid Worldo. The one thing I won't do is the like, you know, Twitter bio, like sanctioned by Putin and like
blocks
like,
by Trump.
Yeah, yeah. Because the reality is like, this is no fucking impact on my life whatsoever.
No one wants to go to Russia.
Every single person who's been sanctioned, with the, I guess, exception of if there's some business person who had some investments there, like your life has not changed, is not a big deal. It's not a big inconvenience. Lindsey Graham is not going to be arrested on some Interpol red notice next year.
No, he's going to put this in a campaign
like,
ad.
Exactly. So there's something so dumb about it. Because like, as you said, like everybody gets to perform. The Ukrainians get to perform about the dying Russians. Then the Russians perform about the American war criminals. And then the American politician performs about like, look at how great I am because I got, you know, sanctioned or arrested. It's just, this is a sideshow and it's fucking stupid.
Absolutely.
And again, I just, the mutual congratulation of people on the sanctions list that Russia puts out. Like, there are now like thousands of these people on this list. Like,
so many.
It's not that special anymore to be on
so
list.
Many.
Not
it's
that
like
it ever was.
The weirdest list of people.
It's the weird fucking list. Yeah.
I don't even get it. A couple more things before we get to the interview. So, Ben, on Monday, the president of Poland said he would sign into law a bill that creates a commission that is ostensibly designed to investigate Russian influence in Poland, but which in practice could allow the Polish government to punish its rivals, including sentencing individuals to have 10-year bans on serving political office. The Polish opposition is calling this proposal Lex Tusk because they believe it's a law specifically targeting the former Prime Minister Donald Tusk ahead of elections later this year. The new commission would investigate the period between 2022 and 2007. Tusk became prime minister in 2007 and served there until 2014. Interesting coincidence on the timing there. During that time, Poland signed a number of energy deals with Russia. Those could hypothetically, you know, be looked at by the commission, which could decide they were too pro-Russian and ban Tusk or his associates from holding political office. So experts say this bill violates Poland's constitution. Duda also says he wants to create a similar entity at the European Union. But in response, the EU says they might punish Poland if Poland enacts this law. The U.S. is criticizing the proposal. So, Ben, I mean, this just strikes me as a very similar playbook that we've seen before. When you have countries that reference, say, the U.S. war on terror as a way to crack down on Muslim communities or civil liberties, it seems like Duda is taking a very cynical but maybe politically clever tact here and saying, oh, no, no, we're just having a conversation about Russian interference like you guys are. That's why I need this commission that could potentially lock out my number one rival in the parliamentary elections this fall.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting is that the Polish government has kind of been going in the Orbán direction for a while.
Definitely.
It's, you know, clearly has ambitions to be kind of a single party nationalist state and intimidate their opponents and control the media, all the rest of it. What's complicated this whole dynamic is Poland has obviously been absolutely central to the war in Ukraine. Most, if not, you know, nearly all of the assistance that flows into Ukraine militarily goes through Poland. Poland is hosting millions of Ukrainian refugees. Mm-hmm. Zelensky, very close to that government for necessary reasons. And so it makes it more uncomfortable and awkward for there to be this divide between Europe and Warsaw. The Polish military, by the way, is getting much stronger. The U.S. is beginning to station permanently military resources in Poland. So there's a lot going on here. And I think part of what Duda is doing is trying to, you know, use the cover of Poland's growing influence and importance to see how far he can push the envelope. Now, with respect to the law, there are real questions and issues around Russian interference in Eastern European politics. We talked about, you know, Serbia earlier. I don't doubt that there aren't legitimate reasons why one might want to look at, okay, is Russia trying to get influence in a place like Poland? But the way the law is crafted doesn't look like that at all, because why would you look at 2007? Why would you roll back the tape to 2007?
Exactly.
You know, like,
and create this extrajudicial sort of entity.
Exactly. This is some earnest desire to just say, like, we need more tools to spot Russian interference in our politics. That'd be one thing. But creating some extrajudicial entity to, like, pick punishment from this massively large window is crazy. Tusk, the irony of this, is like an anti-Russian, pro-European politician.
Right.
Just the fact that he presided over some energy deals wasn't like he was a Russian asset or something.
No, sort of standard.
Angela Merkel was presiding over. Right. Is Angela Merkel like going to be punished in, you know, that context? So I just, this does reek of that overreach. And I think it's going to, again, the longer the war in Ukraine goes on, I think you'll start to see some tensions around things like this.
Definitely. You know? Definitely. The good news here, Ben, is it does sound like, you know, there's going to have to be a review of the constitutionality of the law. It seems like there will be a lot of international pressure on Poland not to do this or to reform it in some way. But we'll see. And we'll keep an eye on it. Also on Tuesday, Ben, so Brazilian President Lula da Silva hosted a meeting of all 12 countries in South America. Lula says he wants to talk about energy, crime, possibly creating a regional currency to displace the U.S. dollar. It's like all on the agenda. Lula, I love Lula. He first pulled together this group during his second term as president. The meeting stopped for a while because, you know, he created this, you know, group of South American countries when it was all lefty leaders. Then a bunch of right wingers came in. They hit pause on bringing this collection together. But now that this meeting is back It means that Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro is in Venezuela as we speak. People who don't know, Maduro is the handpicked successor to former Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. Maduro had a one-on-one with Lula ahead of this broader regional meeting. He called on all South American countries to demand that the United States lift sanctions on Venezuela. Lula also criticized U.S. sanctions, saying it's inexplicable for a country to have 900 sanctions placed on it because another country doesn't like it. Brazil isn't the only country thawing relations with Maduro and Venezuela. Chile recently nominated an ambassador to Venezuela. So Ben, you know, back to our laughing about Lula, like, I'm not surprised at all that he welcomed Maduro into the country. No, that he's criticizing U.S. sanctions.
I mean, this should be a day where we take some victory laps. I think we called this one like 3 years ago when Lula got out of prison that this would happen.
You know? Yeah, well, but here's my question. I mean, do you think that there's any chance that Lula might be able to move the Biden administration off the current hardline policy, or that some of the leftist turn in Latin America? Because again, you know, like the Cuba policy, policy towards Venezuela, we're not seeing a ton of change in a more progressive way, and I would like to.
I think there's a creative tension and constructive tension that can emerge between Washington and Lula, right? You know, the U.S. government's obviously not going to sign on to everything that Lula wants. But a lot of what the U.S. does in Latin America is stupid and self-defeating. And our Venezuela policy is very high on that list. So this policy that had General Marco Rubio and Admiral John Bolton at the forefront of it, for those who don't remember, of recognizing someone who wasn't the president of Venezuela, Juan Guaido, as president of Venezuela on like a legal technicality, kind of pressuring slash bullying a bunch of countries in Latin America and the Europeans to follow suit, and then sanctioning the hell out of Venezuela. Just one of the most catastrophic failures in U.S. foreign policy in recent history, in that Maduro's still there. Juan Guaido just snuck out of the country, like literally snuck out of the country, right? Is now, like last I saw, hanging out up in Northern Virginia doing podcasts, you know, hanging out in Florida.
Right.
Definitely not the president, you know?
No.
And a lot of the right-wing governments that the U.S. like, you know, brought along on this have now been replaced by left-wing governments. Clearly, the U.S. has to make a pretty big shift in its Venezuela policy, because the idea of like just not recognizing this guy as president doesn't work. And meanwhile, we've exacerbated humanitarian crisis there with their sanctions. It has contributed significantly to people coming to our border.
A quarter of the population has left the country.
We need some agreement that lifts a whole bunch of sanctions, that sets an election that we promise to actually respect the result of, you know, even if we don't like the results, and hopefully we do like the results, you know, but that allows for kind of a reset of what's happening between the U.S. and Latin America generally, Venezuela specifically. I would hope, again, that Cuba is a part of this. Lula also, I think, could be a source of useful tension. But keep in mind, a lot of people want to say, oh, this is just Lula. It's not. It's Lula in Brazil. It's Boric in Chile. It's Petro in Colombia. Yeah. It's AMLO in Mexico. It's like all the major Latin American countries. There is nobody with us in this kind of weird Miami-driven hardline policy. While meeting somewhere in the middle between where we currently are and where Lula is, I think, the smart way to go. And honestly, this kind of pressure is not the worst thing to try to shake that loose.
Yeah, look, I'm sure opposition leaders in Venezuela like Juan Guaido and Leopoldo Lopez are very good guys. They have good intentions. But to your point, I mean, this diplomatic effort to sort of install them failed catastrophically. On the other side, I'd love to hear Lula talk, be a little more critical of Maduro's human rights record.
You're right.
You know what I mean?
I sometimes get a little too frustrated at the policy. You're right to call that out, and I'm wrong to have noted. I guess what I'd say, though, is, and this is what I used to always say about Cuba, Leopoldo Lopez was not helped by that Trump policy.
Right.
You know? Juan Guaido, if you look at Juan Guaido's political standing, when he became the Speaker of the Venezuelan National Assembly, and today, it has suffered significantly, right? I wouldn't take shots at the guy for his principles and courage. I'd say the policy that he was made
a
pawn of, right, like, hurt him and hurt the Venezuelan people in the same way that Cuban opposition voices have suffered under the return to really aggressive sanctions. We have to realize that efforts to kind of dislodge to regime change in Latin America is not an expression of support for human rights, even if that's like what it's dressed up as and wrapped up as, you know?
Absolutely. And it's just, it's harming a lot of innocent people.
Yeah.
It's so obvious. Very frustrating.
And you're right that Lula should, you know, this is where Lula's frustrated.
Well, and also, right? I'm sure from Lula's perspective, he's thinking like, there's a trillion voices on the right criticizing this guy's human rights record. No one is saying what I'm saying, which is the sanctions are stupid. Everyone should chill out, respect the sovereignty, et cetera, et cetera. So he probably maybe overcorrects One Direction. Whereas if you got him in a room, he would probably admit to, you know, the complexity here.
Well, but hopefully what Lula could do that we can't is say, hey, could you release some of these political prisoners
yes.
who we've heard have been, you know, treated horribly? Maduro might be able to do that for you, Lula, in a way that he would never do it
exactly.
if we demand it. And
exactly.
so hopefully Lula can play that role too.
Yes.
But, you know, he's often not been willing to.
Well, what he needs is a generational talented emissary like former British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. Who then he appears to be increasingly desperate to find, I guess, anyone who will listen to him, because he was recently in Texas
yes.
meeting with conservative lawmakers and activists to lobby for support for Ukraine and I guess his own relevance. Johnson met with former President George W. Bush. He met with Texas Governor Greg Abbott.
Very relevant figure in geopolitics.
What is he doing? He spoke to the Texas legislature. Politico had a story on this. They noted that surprisingly, Boris was not paid for his speaking engagements in Dallas. But don't worry, he'll get six figures to speak to an investment conference in Las Vegas. Ben, I missed this, but did you see, I guess last month, Trump did an interview with Nigel Farage, of course, where he criticized Boris Johnson, saying he was disappointed by Boris's record in office and that Boris was a bit on the liberal side for his taste. what the fuck is this guy doing in Texas?
It just like he's on a like where in the world is Carmen Sandiego? Like he's on a global tour for relevancy. Because it's also like not even British conservatives, I think, would get a little uncomfortable with the stuff that's been coming out of the Texas legislature. You know,
oh my God, yeah.
Like they literally just passed a law banning DEI in higher education, and
they just impeached their own attorney general for being one of the most corrupt people in the entire country.
Total abortion restrictions, guns everywhere. This is not like something that would travel easily to the UK, but he just clearly likes being applauded and feeling relevant. He wraps it all up in this Ukraine message, you know, like
such
I guess
bullshit.
There's some bank shot if like the fascists in Texas legislature support Ukraine, maybe Republicans will, but like it's just he uses Ukraine as a shield on
exactly.
everything, you know. He did say like I saw him get up and say like keep cutting taxes or something. It's like I don't think that's the problem in Texas. That they have to they don't have a fucking income tax, Boris. You know, like he's not really getting briefed, which is not a surprise.
Yeah, it's so weird. I mean, listen, like Keir Starmer kicked Jeremy Corbyn out of the Labour Party. Rishi Sunak needs to grow some guts and kick Boris Johnson out of the Tory party.
Oh man, yeah, but that would Boris is probably still more liked than Rishi is. That's the problem.
Yeah, you're right. It would probably martyr him. He'd just nail himself to the cross.
Yeah, and he and you know, well, Nigel's already out, but Boris is exhausting.
He's the worst. Last thing before the interview, Ben, just because we love to celebrate our Australian friends. So I was listening to the BBC World podcast on the way into the office. They did a story about a 51-year-old Australian man named Marcus McGowan, who was bitten by a saltwater crocodile while snorkeling at a resort in Queensland and then managed to pry the crocodile's jaws off of his own head and then fight off a subsequent attack. the guy, I think, said out of quote was something like, look, I was in the wrong place at the wrong time. You're damn right you were. Apparently earlier this month, the remains of a fisherman were found inside a different 13-foot crocodile. There's been a resurgence of these saltwater crocs in the area because I think they outlawed hunting for them. So Australians, tougher than you think.
Yeah, I mean.
Some Crocodile Dundee shit right there.
That's like a Jaws sequel right there, right? Like in an IP world where like people need, you know, like you could remake Jaws with a saltwater croc.
What was that crocodile kind of horror-ish movie? Lake Placid, maybe?
Yeah.
It's pretty good. It's like a giant croc.
I think we need, like, and this would have to be set in Australia, obviously.
Definitely. No doubt, because then you have sweet accents and stuff.
I don't know about the hunting. Usually I'm for hunting restrictions, but this one, I don't know. I might want to see a little more hunting.
Yeah, I would
be going to get in the water.
Good with hunting man-eating crocodiles, I guess. Okay.
11 feet, too. Think how long that is. It's a big fucking crocodile.
Massive, man. Yeah. Massive. All right, we're going to take a quick break. You're going to hear two things after the break. My interview with Ece Temelkuran about the recent elections in Turkey. And then Ben and I are just going to talk for a minute about Succession because we love the show. We're sad to see it go. But this is your official spoiler alert. So do not complain at us. I won't hear it.
My name is Sarah, and I got involved with Vote Save America way back in 2018 when it first launched.
My name is Nancy, and I first got involved in VSA in 2018.
Ever since then, Vote Save America has been the best part of my political engagement. Anytime the election anxiety starts to feel overwhelming, I remind myself that my anxiety relief program donation is fueling grassroots organizations around the country.
And VSA has the Political Action Finder, a handy website I've used to find phone banks, knowing that I'm helping to win critical House seats.
In fact, I already signed up to volunteer with the Political Action Finder on the VSA website and helped replace disgraced former volleyball star George Santos.
So if you're someone who doesn't want to wake up on November 6th this year and regret not doing more, and I'm pretty sure you are, go to votesaveamerica.com to get started, and I'll see you at a phone bank soon.
This message has been paid for by Vote Save America. You can learn more at votesaveamerica.com, and this ad has not been authorized by any candidate or candidates committee.
The constant political chaos can be a lot. You gotta mix it up with a little regular chaos. Go behind the pods with Terminally Online, Cricket's loosest show, where the news takes a backseat to the unscripted antics of your favorite Pod Save America and Cricket Media hosts and staffers. Here, love it, learning about dating apps.
I was single in my 20s, and then yada, 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 I was single in my 40s.
Listen to my sage advice on being kind to retail workers. Just smile, walk away, you don't have a right to be an asshole. And enjoy Tommy celebrating the unrelenting wheel of time.
Time comes for all of us. You will all be out of touch with the culture. You'll all be asking someone what some equivalent of a yassified means.
Terminally Online is a subscriber-exclusive show. To get access, subscribe to our Friends of the Pod community at cricket.com/friends.
I am so excited to welcome to the show, back to the show, I should say, Etche Temelkarin. She is a journalist. She's an author of, I think, a dozen excellent books, including How to Lose a Country, and more recently, Together, 10 Choices for a Better Now. Welcome back to the show. It's great to see you.
Hi, Tommy. It's great to be back.
We were just chatting before we started that we were hoping it would be slightly happier circumstances. We're, of course, talking about the election in Turkey. On Sunday, Turkish President Tayyip Erdogan won re-election with 52% of the vote. This was the second round of voting after the first round where no candidate got 50% of the vote, which led to a runoff. Before the first round of voting, there was a sense of hope that Erdogan's main opponent, an opposition leader named Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, might actually win, or that Erdogan might be punished by voters for the government's disastrous response to the earthquake, for example. Do you think that those early hopes were maybe based on false information or naive, or did something change? I mean, how did Erdogan seal the deal here?
Well, first of all, when we're talking about Turkey, it is not completely correct to take these numbers too seriously. During the last decade, millions of Syrian refugees were accepted as citizens on the condition that they're going to vote for Erdogan. Simple as that. I'm talking about millions, so it's like quite a percentage. Secondly, there is massive election fraud. That is also a case. I mean, like, it's almost traditional in Turkey. It is so normal that, you know, the opposition party, opposition coalition, is revealing its program how to protect the ballot boxes from the government. And then thirdly, we have to keep in mind that this is not a competition on an even ground, on an equal conditions at all. Zero. We're talking about a party state. Well, it doesn't look like North Korea maybe from outside, but actually de facto it's almost North Korea. You know, there is no media, mainstream media, which is independent. It is all controlled by the government. And also if you speak against the government, even on Twitter, they find you and take you to the prison. So we're talking about such circumstances. So, yeah, of course, there was hope, you know, in the first round. But Also, it's interesting to point out, to emphasize that Erdogan did not win in the first round. After 20-some years, this was the first election that he didn't win. So second round was far more difficult because we knew that there will be new kinds of cheating, new kinds of deception, and so on. And he also used fake, editings of videos. He used dark propaganda, all the ugly things you can imagine or cannot imagine. So, you know, I'm coming from a complicated country, and people like me who come from complicated countries, we have a habit of breaking down things for Western audiences to make them understand the scale of the situation, scale of the problem. So here's what Turkey is now. Imagine Trump with a political genius for 20 years, plus add to that an unending process of Brexit, that kind of polarization. So we were, fighting against the odds, and we didn't win. I don't think we lost, really, the opposition, because half of the country, despite all the oppression, despite all the fear of empire, despite all the suppression on every level, they still said no to this regime. And we're talking about 20 years, Erdogan created a new generation. And even that new generation did not totally say yes to him. So I think there's still hope there.
Yeah, there's hope. I mean, it's funny, Ben and I were talking about this election as compared to the recent election in Hungary. And you had opposition parties coalesce around a single figure. And, in Turkey, Kılıçdaroğlu was seen as sort of the anti-Erdogan. He would record videos from his kitchen table. Literally, he was this sort of like low-key technocratic guy. And maybe that was seen as the answer. Now I'm seeing some analysts say, well, maybe he wasn't exciting enough or inspirational enough, didn't rally the base the way Erdogan did. Do you have an opinion on whether he was the right candidate for this moment, just as we sort of think about, I don't know, how to tackle people like Erdogan in the future?
Losing against Erdogan in these circumstances does not make a leader the wrong candidate, to put it very plainly. He was not the first choice for many. He wasn't the exciting choice. He wasn't the guy who created enthusiasm, so to speak. But then what he did was amazing throughout the campaign trail. It was full of deeper understanding of humanity. It was speaking to the, basic moral values of the country. It was speaking to the core that made the country a country, basically. Turkey is a very complicated, complex, problematic country. And in such a polarized society, he managed to bring the eternal enemies together. It takes a lot of political charisma, I think, if you're talking about charisma. And also, I think personally, he reached to a political nirvana or something. He's super zen. The attacks that he had to suffer, the bullshit he had to go through, and and he did it with such elegance and grace. I personally in awe of him, and many people, thousands and thousands of people on Twitter, on the election night when the votes were counting, they said the same thing. Thank you. Whatever you've done, it doesn't matter what the result is. Thank you, because we've seen a politician who is embracing the entire country, who is showing us what politics can be, how elegant and graceful and full of love it can be. As you know, or you might know, not know, his sign was this heart shape with hands. Mm-hmm. I know it looks really, really cheesy, but we're talking about a country where lack of love is so solid that it became fatal. I'm talking about basic human love. So it was a very important statement. And he carried out that statement throughout the campaign, despite all the attack that he got, with amazing stamina. So yeah. I think we owe him a lot of appreciation for keeping his cool on such a level. Imagine Trump. again, with political genius, and you're keeping the, you know, going high as they go low. I mean, like, he was the embodied version of that, of that sentence, I think.
Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned Sir Erdogan had support from all over, you know, the media institutions, decades of patronage. He was also able to get financial support and loans from countries like the Saudis, the UAE, Qatar, Russia, to stave off economic problems, and then take that cash and essentially hand out money to people in the run-up to the election.
Yeah.
How important do you think this, you know, autocrat creditor network was to Erdogan's ultimate success?
Absolutely very important. Many people think that it's only this emotional part of the situation, like, you know, the voters, the masses becoming one with the leader and so on, which is very, very prominent. But also Erdogan, since he came to power, like any leader of that kind, he created a web of political money. So the money that he collected from now and from here and there through really, you know, dark ways, he trickled down to his smallest supporter. So this web actually became his security web to keep him in power. So when people were, you know, voting for him, or when they were fighting for him, they were actually fighting for their own livelihoods. This is very important to understand, because when these leaders come to power, what they produce as a political system, as a societal system, becomes unbeatable quite quickly, actually. So that was very important. And then, you know, when you look around the world, Putin, Orban, Erdogan, Bolsonaro, Trump, or several leaders like that, Modi in India, they run their countries like a grocery shop. You don't really know if they have a foreign policy. You don't really know if they have a financial policy. There's this one man who knows everything, and we don't really learn what's going on behind the doors. They go and meet somewhere, as Erdogan and Putin does, for instance. They decide things, and then it becomes country's policy about a certain issue. So I think it's big countries run by autocratic leaders become like mafia mobs. And these mafia mobs are making agreements with each other, and we are following their agreements or disagreements in some cases.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I've heard you say that this victory for Erdogan will essentially lead to fully formed fascism in Turkey. I've seen other analysts say that 5 years from now, Turkey is going to look a lot more like China than sort of a Western, you know, country. Can you help us understand how he'll do that, or how that might happen in practice?
Unfortunately, it will be more complicated than that. I am, you know, trying to conceptualize it with some sort of Dubaiization. It's going to be like something like between Dubai and Afghanistan, let's say. Afghanistan in terms of total destruction of culture and freedom of speech. Dubaiization in terms of no citizenship, the sense of citizenship will be lost. It is already very much damaged, because Erdogan, in every opportunity he has, he said the same thing. You know, he insinuated the same thing, at least, saying that, you know, there are citizens who are my supporters and there are the others. And the others, you don't know what happens with the others, because they are now enemies. For many people in the Western societies, it's not easy to imagine this. And they imagine autocracy or fascism as an abstract concept. Whereas when you, you know, when you talk about fascism in daily life, you mean something like this. For instance, you get divorced. You want to get divorced. And then you want to have the upper hand in the divorce case. And then you suddenly come up with this idea. Oh, my husband has been criticizing Erdogan. And here you go. You know, you get the upper hand. Or suddenly, let's say, you know, smaller things. Like, you know, your neighbor is doing this massive noise. And you go to the police. And the police looks at you and you don't look like an AKP supporter, and your, you know, neighbor is AKP supporter, you know, there is like very, very tiny chance that you get mm-hmm. what you deserve. So imagine this on every level of life, on every wow. bit of life. That is how the daily life is controlled. How fascism infuses into every bit of life. So it will be more and more like this. On the night of the election, and this was a big topic on Twitter in Turkey, many people started to close their accounts on Twitter, on Instagram, on YouTube, because they're afraid now. And even the street, you know, interviewers, YouTube, you know, independent reporters and so on, they were showing people they do not want to talk anymore. They're going away. So this is how it is. The fear will become more and more present, and people will be more and more silent. However, you know, there's good chance that in 2 years, the massive economic crisis that Turkey is going through can damage the image of Erdogan. And even his devotees might be saying enough is enough. Then we'll see. I mean, like, I think Turkey is going to have witnessed like or experienced 2.5 years. I'm expecting that. No scientific evidence, but this is my feeling that it's going to be less than 5 years. That's my point.
With the sort of massive inflation and Erdogan just pumping money into the economy to sort of get through today and not sort of thinking about the longer term, is that sort of what you're looking at?
But yeah, also, not only that, there's something deeper than that. Erdogan gathered all the conservative forces to stay in power. And these conservative forces include Turkish Hezbollah, which is absolutely a criminal organization. You know, they are famous for, I don't know the English word for that, but like, you know, they're famous for certain kind of torture, killings and so on. And they're radical Islamists. And now they have MPs in the parliament. So we will see if the fundamental contract of Turkish society can accommodate this kind of politics in the parliament or not.
Right.
Because this is a country that has been secular, at least nominally, that has been democratic nominally. And now there is a clear, you know, change of direction to ultra nationalism and radical Islamism. It was mm-hmm. there already since 20 years, a new generation was born, as Erdogan calls them, that cling to their religion and wrath. But this time it is more serious, and people are fearing for the lives of their daughters first, because we're talking about this Hezbollah, Turkish Hezbollah, now turning to a party, becoming MPs. They want the single women to be owned, adopted, so to speak, like pets. So yeah, it's going to be a interesting time for Turkey, not in a good way, obviously, but yeah.
Well, that sounds terrifying. I mean, the other evolution I think we're kind of watching in real time is in Washington, and sort of the ongoing reassessment of the U.S.-Turkey relationship. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, Ben and I were talking about how, you know, in 2009 we went with Obama to Turkey, you know, sort of seen as this success story that was worth highlighting. Now you have the Biden administration essentially openly rooting against Erdogan in this election, and now they have to figure out how to work with him. Biden wants Sweden into NATO. There's this debate going on about selling Turkey F-16 fighter jets, sort of this on-again, off-again sale. What do you think Erdogan wants out of the U.S.-Turkey relationship? And are there things you think the U.S. can or should do to moderate his behavior or create some guardrails?
Two things. Unfortunately, that enthusiasm coming from United States and Western bloc for Erdogan turned him into a so-called global leader. And I remember 10 years how those audiences applauded him, you know, boosted his ego and so on. So I really expected Biden administration showing the same enthusiasm for Kılıçdaroğlu, to be honest. Because, you know, yes, we have this problem of Erdogan, but we didn't on our own create this problem. It was, you know, Erdogan was shown as the exemplary leader for the Muslim world. And he was really vetted for it, for that position. And United States administration had a lot in that. This is the first thing. The second thing is, let me put it this way. These leaders, including Putin, you know, Erdogan, whoever you want, this ilk of politicians, they thrive on the moral fragility, to put it politely, of the Western societies, Western governments, rather. European Union, as you know, has been making agreements with Erdogan to keep the refugees in Turkey, and they were literally paying for each person. That money, we don't know where that money went. I mean, like, Erdogan got that money and we don't know how it was used. That's one thing. But then, you know, can you imagine European Union being absolutely enthusiastic for Kılıçdaroğlu coming to power when they know that they cannot do the same indecent, you know, deal with them?
That's a good point.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought about that, yeah.
You know, F-16s are no less indecent. My point is that. So if you want democracy to win, excuse me, you have to cooperate with democratic forces. You cannot do, like, you know, we want democracy, but also if they don't have democracy, we can go on business as usual. No, it doesn't work like that. I mean, like, I'm not expecting United States to you know, rescue Turkish people from this anti-democratic government, blah, 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 blah. No, we can do it on our own. However, they have to keep in mind that, you know, collapse of Turkish democracy, the total final collapse of Turkish democracy will have far more bigger consequences, more far more deeper consequences than Syria falling down. Turkey is now the front line of fight against new authoritarianism or new fascism. If you lose it there in that front line, just you can be sure the next front line is Central Europe or Western Europe even.
Yeah, no, I that's a really good point. I think the US relationship with places like Turkey has often been, you know, the long-term goals are undercut by short-term priorities that are usually revolve around fighting terrorism in some sort of nebulous sense in these security relationships, which lead the US to do things like, I don't know, sell the Saudis $1 billion worth of military hardware while they, you know, suppress women, for example.
When it comes to women, which one is more expensive? Okay, the nukes. So let's go for the nukes.
We have to think a little more long-term. Well, speaking of long term, I mean, that was a final question for you. We in the U.S., you might have noticed, are trying to fend off an autocrat who wants to return to office. Yeah, we've got kind of a low key technocrat named Joe Biden in office now, who's doing a pretty good job on a number of fronts. But, you know, his approval is stuck. He's got this sort of bombastic, venal Donald Trump waiting in the wings. Any advice for us on how to approach an election like this?
I give the same advice to British people as well, because you two countries on each side of the pond, you have the same kind of funny hair in your life as a political threat. That's why actually my advice is not to laugh too much, because you're laughing because they have funny hair.
They too have funny hair.
Yeah. But I think we have to be careful about our laughter, when we laugh, how we laugh, to whom we laugh, and with whom we laugh together. Because we, you know, once you start laughing at them, you don't know when it becomes too serious that you cannot laugh anymore, or you're laughing on your own. I think United States is better in taking it seriously than Britain, to be honest. This is my observation. Not enough political energy and determination is put into how to fight against anti-democratic forces. There is this belief that we can still fix it if we get rid of this guy, get rid of that guy, that leader, and so on. No, unfortunately, it's not the case. Imagine Trump, only 4 years he was in power, and now women in United States are in big trouble because of the abortion issue, because he did just one, you know, appointment, and then everything is gone. So what they are doing, the damage that they're creating, is far serious than we think. So we have to be, one, careful, but second, we have to do the boring job. Like, you know, making fun of Trump is easy. Attacking him on Twitter is easy. What is more boring yet difficult is to follow which appointments he did, to follow where he's going, what he's really saying, and to take him seriously.
Yeah, the long-term structural work of defending a democracy and party building. Ece, thank you so much for joining the show. In 5 years, we're going to do this again, and we're going to talk about how, no, 2.5 years.
2.5 years,
excuse me.
Erdogan
got tossed out of office.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're both, you know, building this brighter future for both countries that does not include Erdogan, Boris Johnson, Donald Trump, or any of these creeps.
Well, actually, I want to see Donald Trump as a TV star. That would be nice.
Okay. Okay, great. Yeah, give him a show somewhere. I don't care where it is. Maybe in Russia, RT or something. Thank you again. It was great talking to you.
Thank you, Tommy. Thanks.
Thank you again to Ece for joining the show. Fantastic interview as always. This is your spoiler alert. We're about to talk about Succession. We have engineers in the studio literally putting their fingers in their ears. So here we go. Now we're going to talk about it. So turn off the podcast. Okay. What'd you think?
I thought it was fucking great.
I loved it.
I loved it because I thought it kind of like was very OG Succession, right? Like the election night one and the funeral were like just some of the best television I've ever seen. Just these high wires. But it kind of went all the way back to the basics in the last one. Like we're back with the kids. We're back with like the rot of like late stage capitalism and their monstrous father and the fact that they are all going to lose in the end. And if this is basically a metaphor for like how America itself has like become a dying empire, the end of this like captured that perfectly, right? That like this kind of Elon Musk Swede comes in, buys up the thing that is like rotting America so he can profit off of it. And these kids are just not even up to the task of holding on to what they think should be theirs. You know?
What their father created and why he hates them and refuses to let them take over. Here's what I loved about it, just from like kind of a TV writing perspective.
Yeah.
Sometimes shows that go on for this many seasons have plot points that you think of and are like, hey, remember when that happened? Like in Game of Thrones, there were the White Walkers that just kind of disappeared after like episode 6 in the final season. It was just like that plot line wasn't relevant anymore. And I was always just like bothered by it. You know, like, come on, this was like the driving force in the show, the wall for the entire time. And now we don't care about that anymore. I felt a little bit of that when it came to, hey, remember when Kendall killed a guy?
Yeah.
Seems like that was a big deal that we're never talking about, right? But him lying about telling his brothers or admitting to that to his brothers and sisters seemingly came back to bite him in the ass in the very end, because they were kind of like, if you're such a psychopath that you would lie to us about that, then we can't trust you with anything.
And it just shows that like, this is why like Kendall is actually like the beating heart of the show as much as like Logan Roy was like the fun part to watch, because like he's just so broken. Like nothing matters to the guy.
So broken.
And yet even though he gets, because the other thing I was like thinking about is that his father used to always tell him, like, you don't have to be willing to be a killer. You have to be willing to do anything. Like, and he was.
Yeah.
Like, he was willing.
He finally got there.
He got there. Like, at the end, he was willing to even lie about the thing that he did, that he told the siblings about. And having got there, he still can't get hold of it. You know? it is just like that. And to me, that's why Kendall's, like, the heart of the whole thing. I saw Jeremy Strong, who, like, you know, gets shit for being like a bit serious. And
he sounds like way over the top, like super method actor, a horrible person to be around at times. There's that crazy New Yorker yeah. profile of him where he just sounded like not fun to hang with.
I totally dig it though. Like I listened to like some interview with him where he quoted like in the course of the interview, like young Shakespeare, you know, like he's just, but like oh, he's no. in it. He's like deep fucking in it. And his point was that he always thought of Kendall as this like metaphor for like late stage capitalist America. And you've given everything up and sacrificed everything and you somehow have still lost everything, you know? Even if, though he's still like fabulously rich.
That's a funny thing. They're also worth like billions.
Yeah. He's staring in the water, but he's like worth like $1.7 billion or something,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah. You could buy that water.
I liked the ending on Kendall. I liked that Roman is like got a martini and seems to be smiling at the end. Like, you know what? Actually, maybe it's not the worst thing that I'm out, you know?
Yeah.
I kind of like that Shiv and Tom are like chained together in their miserable existence. I love that Cousin Greg survives to fight another day.
I love the Greg Tom dynamic is something that's the part of the show I miss the most.
I love that. Speaking of world, those Connor's going to Slovenia. We could do a spinoff of just Connor as ambassador in Slovenia.
I was talking to Max about this. Max is so impressed by Connor's knowledge yeah, of yeah. random diplomatic posts. You know,
when he says to the fascist president-elect, he's like, Pan Habsburg alternative to the EU. Thoughts? Like, it's actually the most worldo line that's ever appeared in.
So funny. Yeah. So funny when they're first talking about, what was it? Was he offered Somalia?
Yeah.
So, Mogadishu, so, I think. Yeah, yeah. It's like, a little too car bomby.
Yeah, yeah. A little too car bomby. It's good.
So
I give it A+. I'm going to miss it. And I'm worried that we're never going to see another show like that. The fact that HBO Max, like the Discovery and their like corporate right-wing overlords decided the Max is a better brand than HBO.
For show.
When Max, all I think about is like watching like soft porn when I was like
Skinamax,
you know, 19 years old.
What like, were they thinking?
That, you know, that just shows you that you're not going to get another Succession because all those prestige shows are HBO shows.
I was listening to Kara Swisher and Scott Galloway talking about the Max rebrand. It's like, yeah. imagine taking the most valuable brand in all of media and just burning it yeah. because a new CEO came in and was like,
it's too pretentious.
I don't want the last crew yeah. to like get any credit. I need to restamp this with my identity.
But Succession will always have that as a document. By the way, and it'll be a fun one to go back and watch in the beginning again.
So Hannah hadn't watched it for the first two or three seasons, so I rewatched them all with her, I think during COVID, and it was a blast to rewatch.
Shiv is better in the arc of it all, too,
yeah,
right? Because like her character lagged a bit, no fault of the great Australian actress, Sarah Snook, but like, you know, she had better plot lines early on. And to your point, like, the things she does towards the end of the series make sense if you remember where this kind of started at the beginning and her whole relationship with Tom and all the rest of it.
Yeah, so, they really tied it together well.
Yeah.
And there's so many like great fanfic theories. Like some people think that Tom was named after some random baseball player that played in like the 1920s that performed a triple play on his own. And the writers had to come out and be like, no, man.
No, it's just a funny name.
Frank Rich is like, what are you talking about?
The one thing that is cool is that this is such a British show, right? It's like Jesse Armstrong, this genius showrunner. And then, you know, Brian Cox, the actor.
Who's in Super Troopers.
Yeah, yeah. The guy who plays Tom, I think, is a Brit.
Yeah, he's a Brit.
The woman who plays Shiv is an Australian. But it is kind of like telling that this is what smart Brits think of America. You know, we're very critical of UK politics on this show, but like we got it, you know, in our direction. This is what we must look like to the rest of the world. You know?
There's some really telling lines, like when Madsen is talking to Shiv and he's like, you've only been a democracy for like 50 years. And she's like, what do you mean 50 years? He's like, well, that's when you guys like gave black people full rights. Yeah. So, you know, you probably shouldn't discount that. You guys have a tendency to do that. And it's like such like a perfectly articulated
dagger at
sort of U.S. identity.
He said, like, you and Botswana, you know, it's about as long as Botswana. What do you, is Madsen, in your mind, is he like Elon Musk? Is he like, like some mixture of like Spotify and Mark Zuckerberg? Like, no, what do you think he is?
That's a good question. I don't know that I was able to pinpoint him. I do think they gave him sort of like a musky
vibe,
archetype where, you know, he's sort of inscrutable and then is revealed to be just kind of a bozo in some ways and a creep and, you know, just sort of like a typical shitty CEO.
I think what they did well with him is that when you're first introduced to him, you think, oh, this guy is really smart. He's kind of like a genius. And then the more you get to know him, you're like, actually, no, he's just as big a boob as the rest of them.
He fakes
talks better and he's European, so he sounds better. And that's actually like our experience with every tech CEO.
Absolutely.
Like, you're always like, this person's a genius. The first time you encounter Elon Musk or Mark Zuckerberg, you're like, what a genius. And then like, you're like, the more you get to know these people, you're like, these people are just kind of full of shit. And
the shine comes off.
They kind of got lucky with something and hired the right coders or something.
Yeah. exactly. Luck and timing. Okay, well, that's it for our recap. That was fun.
That was fun.
Let's do that again soon.
I just wanted to be able to do that. Yeah.
Let's pick another show and just do a recap.
We should. There's
let's just turn this into the rewatchables.
Yeah, exactly. Why not?
Done. All right, guys. We will talk to you next week. Pod Save the World is a Crooked Media production. Our executive producers are me, Tommy Vitor, Ben Rhodes, and Michael Martinez. Our producer is Haley Muse. Our associate producer is Ashley Mizuo. It's mixed and edited by Andrew Chadwick, Kyle Seglin, Charlotte Landis, and Vasilis Futopoulos are our sound engineers. Thanks to our digital team, Elijah Cohn, Phoebe Bradford, and Milo Kim, who upload our episodes and videos to YouTube every week. And check out the Pod Save the World YouTube account. Thanks to Saul Rubin for production support.